Hi, Thomas.
Hello.
So, it's been a situation that's happened a few days ago. Hamas out of Gaza has both invaded Israel, taken some hostages, shot a bunch of people, retreated back into Gaza, and now Israel's responding. Some people think this is the start of World War III. Some people believe that this is all one big giant conspiracy from on the Israeli side to allow them to annihilate Gaza. Other people believe this is a symbol or a symptom of a general competency crisis, and it's showing that Israel is not as strong as we once were led to believe. So we brought Thomas on. Because I couldn't think of anyone else better to talk about this in, at least in this sort of initial burst of activities, to share his thoughts. I think we're pre-recording this. Usually we do these things live. We don't know what's going on with YouTube and censors and all the rest of it. I don't want anyone ever to have to protect their words or say anything that they don't think is true. So we'll just have the conversation, and this may pop up on YouTube, it might pop up on some other places, who knows. Thomas, thanks again for coming on. Thoughts in general on the Israeli-Hamas conflict?
There's three layers here that conceptually that need to be addressed. And within one of those layers, there's a couple main subjects that need to be addressed. There's a military and strategic aspect to this. There's a political aspect, and there's a historical aspect that is impacting affairs globally today. And within that political aspect, it's not a normal war and peace paradigm. Israel's a totally abnormal state. I don't think that's controversial. Even people don't agree with my views and values shouldn't find that controversial. Ernst Nolte made the point, and Martin van Creveld, the Dutch Israeli historian, stipulated this, directly citing Nolte. Okay, Israel, the Soviet Union, and the Third Reich were totally abnormal states. In just value-neutral terms, they weren't normal countries. And they all developed in dialogue with each other and out of a zeitgeist of crisis, okay, that discreetly impacted the radicalized populations that created those respective political cultures. The only one of those states that still exists is Israel. That's one of the reasons why, I mean, America's policy corridors have totally been co-opted by Zionist interests. I mean, that goes without saying. But one of the reasons, but that aside, one of the reasons why the way people talk about Israel doesn't make any sense is because I don't think they truly understand this conceptually. I mean, I don't think people really understand politics in any meaningful way generally. I mean, not because I'm so smart that I do, but this is pretty much all I do. Israel's not a quote-unquote democracy. That doesn't make any sense, okay? It's not a democracy in kind of the Aristotelian sense. It's not a democracy in kind of like the liberal shorthand sense. And like nobody in the Israeli government or no like hardcore Zionist would like suggest that. So that's just bizarre. That doesn't make any sense. Like, nor is Israel kind of this like Rhodesia or South Africa kind of like realist like racial state that's trying to manage, you know, kind of the reality of an emboldened like colored world, or during the Cold War we call third world. Like, they're not that either. Like, Zionism isn't premised on that, okay? It's premised on this idea that the Jews are discrete and insular people, unlike all other people. They're uniquely threatened in existential terms by everybody else. Nobody else really has a legitimate right to racial posterity or like blood posterity, if you want to look at it like that, except for Jews. It's absolutely imperative that this kind of right to that posterity be protected at all costs. And that that's completely at odds with not just kind of hard and fast, like realist logic, but it's totally at odds with what kind of the prevailing like value system is of globalism. Just on its own terms. Okay. However, it's inextricably bound up with that. And that's why I'm always making the point that, you know, much of it seems to be like at odds with kind of like, you know, the global liberal paradigm, what I think of as the social engineering Nuremberg paradigm. It's actually like an inextricable like component of it. But it's something that people don't like to discuss openly, like the minority that does actually understand the nuances of it, because that raises contradictions that can't really be mitigated by appeals to you know, the kind of self-contained ethics of the aforementioned system. But that's the way to understand Israel. That's what I always say to people, and I'll bring it back in a minute. I don't want to proselytize or something. People are like, oh, I don't care what all those savages do. It's like, well, you better care, man, because you're being ruled by these people, okay? And whether you're talking about the war in Ukraine, whether you're talking about the war in Syria, and by the way, like the reason why American Israel went all in against Russia and Ukraine is because of what happened in Syria, by the way. Okay. So you can like pretend like you don't care about that, but if that's truly the case, like don't complain about wokeism. Don't complain about, you know, like the excesses of the Biden administration. Like don't complain about these crazy people like Lindsey Graham just like targeting half the countries in the world for annihilation, for being insufficiently like woke or something, because it's all like bound together within the same kind of like conceptual nexus. Okay. But to bring it back, what's different about this conflict cycle from previous ones between Israel and all of their neighbors since 1948? I believe that clearly, I think Hamas is performing better than they have before, and in large part the sectarian, the kind of terribly sanguinary sectarian division between Shia and Sunni, at least in limited operational terms, has been overcome. Okay, because Hezbollah and Hamas, and Hezbollah is probably the best infantry element in the Middle East. Okay, that's not arguable. Like again, Van Creveld, he like stipulates that. Okay. They are very, very tough. They're a real fighting force. They're not just like ragtags or like crazy jihadis or something. They're not even like really in that culture. I mean, they're overwhelmingly Shia, for, you know, for one. But it's long been the claim by people who would be in a position to know that Hamas has been drilling with Hezbollah, and there's been some operational integration there. Okay. And at least at like company level, like Hamas seems to have like gotten its act together. Okay. So that's what's different. At the same time, kind of the myth of like Israeli like superiority on the battlefield, that's kind of been overstated. I mean, 1973 kind of like squashed that sensibility. Okay. And that's one of the reasons why the Camp David Accords became so imperative, because first of all, it like removed Egypt from the Soviet camp. But it also, it like Israel basically realized, like, we've got to come to the negotiating table with some of these people, okay? Because this is not manageable. So what's different now, again, is the operational sophistication of the op for that Israel is fighting. But also, there's a basic irrationality that's unprecedented to America and Israel these days. You know, like, and you see this in the Ukraine war, too. Like, how everyone would feel with the Ukraine war, this is just being allowed to continue in perpetuity. Like, that's not how you manage politics. That's not how you manage war and peace. You know, you don't just say, like, Moscow is evil and we're going to drag this war out as long as possible. Like, that's irrational. That's not what you do. You know, you don't saying, you know, Netanyahu saying 1 billion people are all evil and they hate us and we will never stop fighting them. Because anti-Semitism, that's not rational, and that's not sustainable. The only real comparable paradigm what Israel's dealing with is what South Africa was dealing with from P.W. Botha until the end of the existence of the Boer Republic. Like, I'm not saying there's like moral equivalence between the two countries. Obviously, my sympathy is with Afrikaners. I mean, they're quite literally like my people. I mean, they're Reformed and they're, you know, Germanic, and you know, they're a pioneer population like us in America. But aside from all of that, like there was always more of an interdependence between white South Africans. You know, it's like Clive W. Lewis said, there's not like white South Africans and black people. You know, there's dozens of ethnicities in South Africa, like some of which were adjacent to the white minority, some of which were neutral to it, some of which were actively at war with it. But there was never anybody in South Africa, except maybe the most unhinged Yahoo. There was no man ever in government who said, we're going to like perpetually wage war on every black ethnicity because they hate us and we will never surrender or give a single inch. Like, you can't conduct politics that way. You just can't. You know, you can't declare everybody but me is evil. I will never negotiate under any circumstances. But that's a uniquely Zionist thing to do. Like, nobody else thinks that way. Like, to think that way, you've got to believe in some deep and axiomatic way. No one else is really human. Nobody else has a legitimate claim to anything. You know, nobody else is acting in a way I must abide for any reason at all, because only I matter. You know, only my ambitions are valid. And beyond that, I simply don't need to abide anybody else's claims, even for pragmatic or reasons or basic reasons of physical security, because I am always right and everyone else is always wrong. Like, that's literally the way these people think. I'm not just like being funny or something. So that's my basic takedown. Kind of, I realize there's a lot there, but you know, yeah. And I don't.
Well, no, I think what, just to jump in for a second, I think what underscores it is that we've seen now over the last, since 2020, really, this, what I call sort of Saturday morning cartoon logic being applied to health issues, to the war in Ukraine, and now the situation with Hamas, where people are saying truly outrageously stupid things, as you've said, like a war to end, you know, to a never ending war that has no end goal, has no, seemingly has no other point other than to mass murder people. That seems to be the only, like, we can just look at the Ukraine situation. Like, Bakhmut still is a, I strain my brain to conceive of a reason for it. You know, you have to almost make up stuff that is also Saturday morning cartoon stuff. Like, maybe there's something hidden in the salt mines. Maybe there's like, there must be something else, right? Because you strain for rationale. Why would a country send its people into a meat grinder for nothing, for a podunk town that used to have, yeah, a salt mine in it? Like, it doesn't conceivably make any sense.
Well, it's also like in the case for Israel, like I made the point to people before, look, if you don't like Arabs or Muslims, I do, and a lot of them are my comrades. If you don't like them, that's fine. You don't have to like anybody you don't want to. But if you're gonna sit around, it's, you know, Gaza literally is an open air prison. Okay. Like, it is. It's a giant concentration camp. It's not hyperbole, that's what it is. Okay, these people are basically under a permanent blockade in an open-air prison. Now, it doesn't mean you need to feel bad about that. It doesn't mean you need to sympathize for these people. But saying, like, those people are savages and fuck all of them. You know, if you're going to be a bigot, man, like, be a bigot in favor of your own people. Don't be some, like, fucking dumb hick and, like, decide you're going to be, like, a bigger Jewish bigot than Jews themselves. I mean, like, that's just, like, fucking asinine. And it's also, again, it's like, you know, there's something... You know, these people in Gaza, you know, unless people are truly talking about, God forbid, like the political will and technology to like kill every single one of these people, or beyond that, to kill literally 1 billion people who populate Darul Islam, you're going to have to deal with these people. That's reality. Okay. Adults within reality understand that. And that saying, fuck everybody else, I'm going to kill you as long as I can, that's not policy. You know, and also I'll add, you know, you mentioned before we went live about the competency crisis and its relationship to military affairs. One of the reasons I'm sure, I mean, that Israel does not have meaningful human intelligence, which despite what people claim still matters, especially if you're talking about a literal like racial war, you know, where people live quite literally on top of each other. You know, if you're gonna try and like erect like grand apartheid between populations and just absolutely refuse like any kind of meaningful negotiation, even if it's just to achieve some kind of peace at distance, like you're not gonna be able to understand the strategic paradigm as it impacts you in very intimate terms. And since Rabin was assassinated, that's like a whole other issue. But the course, Israel produced some fairly competent statesmen, like whatever I think about Israel or anything else, you know, before the mid-1990s. Like after Rabin was killed, that really was the ascendancy of Likud in permanent capacities. And I'm not saying there's like, I don't want to get into like whether, like why he was killed. It really was a conspiracy. People have strong feelings about that. That's not my point. Like subsequent to that event, like Netanyahu, like a crook, the guy's just, there's something wrong with him. You know, like he's not an intelligent person. He's not a reasoned guy. And he's certainly not a man you want as warlord. You know, like Sharon might have been a terrible person and like not a good guy, but before he became elderly and kind of compromised by, you know, as people do when they get old, you know, he was a career military man, and you know, that did, however objectionable, you know, in the long term, like Likud's orientation towards the problem was, you know, at least like one could say that like within the bound of rationality of operational military affairs, like Sharon like had his shit together. I mean, like Netanyahu's a fucking buffoon. You know, he really is. You know, and it's I don't see how a man like that and you know, like a crony cabinet around him can see their way out of this. But you know, it's also, I mean, the amazing thing about Israel is I think Michael Scheuer, I mean, sometimes he seems unhinged, but I think sometimes during the Iraq War especially, I think he was I think he was doing God's work, but he made the point years back, how can you make an enemy of everybody? You're at war with the Shia, you're at war with the Sunni, you're at war with the Christians, you're at war with the Arabs, you're at war with the Persians, you're at war with the, like, you're literally not at war with anybody. I mean, like, how is that sustainable, man? You know, like, that doesn't make you some kind of, like, base badass or some kind of, you know, or some kind of, like, lone Spartan contingent, you know, against all odds. It makes you crazy. Or it makes you suicidal, or it makes you like self-defeatingly incompetent. You know, I mean, I think that's, I wasn't rambling a bit, but that's, yeah, man. I mean, these things are all very,
well, no, but I think it underscores this sort of idea is like, you know, one of the things that I got very good at, especially with the Ukraine Russia thing, and I think is because when media reports started talking, it was something that I've been following for 30 odd years.
Sure.
And when media reports started coming out and talking about Putin acting in ways that Putin has never acted, I was like, oh, so you're talking about Bill Putin. Like, this isn't Vladimir Putin. This is some other guy.
Yeah.
This is Rob Putin or whatever. Who I don't know who, yeah, yeah, who you're, yeah, talking, yeah, about.
Yeah, or like Gerald Putin, like my cousin from the hood or whatever. Right.
And it's amazing to me how propaganda works until it hits you and it hits up against your actual knowledge about a situation. You're like, no. What are you just talking about? The same thing with Israel now, I feel, is that, you know, when I first saw the reports, you're automatically going, well, wait, where's the IDF? Where's this? Where's that? You know, where's their intelligence? Like this, we're always told this is world-class intelligence. And then you catch yourself saying it. You're like, wait a minute, how do I know that? And why do I know that? And more importantly, why do I want this to be true? Because almost everything in the media narrative structure is based on that. You want something to be true for some reason. You desire this thing. And it's going to feed you the information that confirms that desire, that Israel is this badass country in the Middle East, that, you know, the IDF and the intelligence services out of Mossad is just like, you know, all knowing, all seeing, can do everything. And you better not screw with these guys because they're total badasses. In reality, it might just be a bunch of 19-year-old girls who don't want to go serve in the military, who are now, you know, who you might be in a situation where your operative army has a competency crisis. There's one report out of that I mentioned before we went live that it's quite possible that that Israel's low on artillery, so their Iron Shield doesn't have the right missiles. They don't have enough artillery to just attack Gaza from a distance. Hamas is now taking.
Yeah, they've been they've been waging a war against Syria for no particular reason for, you know, a decade and a half. I mean, like, it, which again, like I said, and I mean, the fact that they got their face broken by Russia and Hezbollah, in Syria. I mean, that's why they went all in, against Russia and Ukraine when they did. But as regards to the Mossad and intelligence matter, I firmly believe, like I said, and I haven't visited the Holy Land, but I do know a fair amount of guys who are from there, who are there now, not in the battle space, but like guys in the Levant told me, you know, in the past 30 years, especially, like, you don't really associate, like, if you're a Muslim or if you're a Christian, you don't really associate with Israelis like you used to. Like, these people used to, whatever the bad blood was, whatever the wider political paradigm, you know, whatever kind of apartheid features kind of drove a wedge between, you know, people in kind of common spaces. There was a basic, you know, they'd socialize in some basic way. And of course, you know, there'd be the odd kind of like marriage across the ethnic, racial, sectarian line. But I mean, the less that happens, like, the less you're going to be able to insinuate yourself into these spaces, and you're not really going to know what you're not going to have a conceptual picture of like what the Gaza Street is doing. And it's also too, literally, like I said, I don't resort to hyperbole, man, unless I'm like making fun of stuff. The Gaza Strip is literally an open air prison. Israel's disengagement from it, there's this kind of like demilitarized zone, like barrier strip that's hyper militarized, that Palestinians are forbidden to transverse. There's essentially like a permanent embargo on it, you know, in terms of essential goods. The overwhelming majority of people who live there are the people who were displaced by the ethnic cleansing operation from 1946 to 1949. It's like an iron cage. That's the term like Rashid Khalidi used for it. Okay, so if you're basically treating these people like you're a warden or you're a jail cop and they're your charges, you don't know what they're up to. Like you're not getting good human intelligence. And if your notion is we don't have to deal with these people because we're Israel and fuck everybody else on the planet, you know, you're not going to have the psychology for that either. Like, if you want to understand people, you have to like walk among them. Okay. And like, if you're not of their race, there's always going to be like barriers, but they are going to like come to like you, even like in spite of themselves. Okay. And they are going to like get comfortable at least around you. And you're going to like pick up like tells. You're going to like overhear things. You know, you're going to like observe pattern, even among like very insular peoples. And in the Middle East, I mean, they're like the insular of insular peoples, frankly, a lot of these populations. So you're never going to have like a complete picture, kind of like their cultural mind, but you are going to discern when things change or when the kind of like war drums are sounding around Gaza in like subtle ways. And I don't believe Israel can do that anymore for reasons I said. But again, I've not been there on the ground. I mean, people can tell me that this is totally off base, but I don't think it is. Okay, there's comparable precedent for things like that, where the capability to devise a picture from human intelligence just like completely disappears for reasons I said, because of total isolation at, you know, kind of like the most basic like human level of sociality. But all for all of too, like the IDF is like the U.S. Army, and it's like full of like fucking fat people and like idiots and like, you know, intersexed like women who weigh like 400 pounds. I don't know. And if that's the case, yeah, I'm sure that's not helping any.
So what do you think? Okay. One of the main concerns here was, because they've already listed in the media a few things. This is what I found interesting and disturbing at the same time. They're claiming that when Hamas broke through the lines, shot up a rave or an outdoor festival and kidnapped a bunch of women, mostly, and went back into the Gaza. There's now reports that they're gang raping these women, which is, you keep seeing this narrative pop up. I just did a preliminary like search on it, like, where is this coming from? And it seems to be the only confirmation I could get from it was that the report of gang rape came from an account on X. It was called the Israeli War Room. that are making these claims. What I think is important for people to understand is, like, there's some things that you can deal with, just small little things, and then go, okay, if they're lying about this, or if this is inconclusive, why are they repeating it, and where does this lead us to?
Okay, well, what I can say to that, man, is, you remember in 1990 there was a testimony before Congress by that Kuwaiti nurse who said that when the Iraqis invaded, I was a nurse, and they took all the babies out of incubators and threw them on the floor and they died. And then they, like, raped all the boys and girls, like, you know, these, like, teenage boys and girls, you know, and then they went from bed to bed and, like, massacred, like, all the elderly and invalids. And then it comes out, like, 5 years later, that lady was a member of the Saudi royal family. She worked with this, like, big international PR firm. Like, she wasn't a nurse. This story was literally made up by, like, these Madison Avenue, like, horror story writers. You know, like, this sounds like made up, but it's not. Like, that happened. I mean, it's like, do I find it hard to believe that, like, very jumped up, angry young men would, like, gang rape women in a war zone? I do not find that hard to believe at all. But it's like, why are there these, like, pictures where it's like a found footage horror movie of these, like, pretty girls being led away and these, like, grimy looking, like, kind of stereotypical, like, dirtbag Arab guys, like, you know, like, acting on, like, why, what's, like, what is this? It's like the Blair Witch Project, like, Arab rape edition. Like, it doesn't, like, who's taking this footage? Like, I was like, oh, this is me committing war crimes. I mean, I'm sure there's some of that, like, but it's weird, man. And it's like, what was the War Department's big coup after Wilson's war declaration? It's like this King Kong gorilla in the poster with, like, a naked girl over his shoulder. Stop this!
Oh, man. Yeah, the Eternal Huns. Yeah, yeah.
Raping German girls. Yeah. Why is it always rape? You know, like, you got to save them. You got to save these like poor girls being raped by these, like, brutes. That's always the narrative. And now, again, I'm not trying to be flippant. Like, women get raped constantly in war, and that's fucked up. Like, I'm not saying that does not happen, but it's like, why is that always the narrative? You know, and it's like, I mean, I know why, but it's like, it's also, I mean, I don't, but you know, at some point it's like, what's the point? I can pull up, like, gross pictures all day of, like, little kids, like, little Arab kids playing soccer who got, like, fucking lit up by, like, 50 caliber ammunition. Like, what does it prove? Like, bad things happen at war. Like, I don't, it's like,
well, that's
go wrong if, like, Hamas does fucked up shit. Like, I don't, okay. I mean, I don't accept that.
That's the interesting part about this whole thing, right? Because it's bad enough that Hamas did invade that rave. I don't think there's any contention about that. Did shoot people at that festival, did kill people at that festival, and did take prisoners, ostensibly for, now there's speculation going crazy about why they did that, whether it's being using them as human shields or as exchangeable tokens or as a way to draw the Israeli military into Gaza and then have urban warfare. I'm open to all those possibilities. The thing that I rejected off the top of it is that it doesn't make, typically speaking, when people take when people kidnap people in a time of war, they tend not to mistreat those people that horribly. I mean, I'm not saying they're putting them at the Ritz, but it doesn't make any sense for them to visit horrors upon them when they could just shoot them in the head. Right.
It's like also, I mean, there's again too, there's like horrible sexual violence that happens at war, but it's like, in the opening salvos of these guys, so presumably if they're in a kind of first wave operationally on the Hamas side, I mean, presumably these guys would be kind of like the hardened cadres, you know, they'd at least led by guys where they're equivalent of like pretty experienced NCOs. Like, their first order of business is to like kidnap girls to like rape them. Like, that's, I mean, aside, morality and fucked up aspects of that aside, like that represents kind of a breakdown in military discipline, like, immediately. I mean, that's not, you can't, in terms of just like military necessity and pragmatism, you can't like have men doing that kind of thing. You know, like again, not to minimize like the horror of like sexual violence, but you know what I mean. And like, it's, but the whole thing is, it's smacked of, you know, like what I said, like these kinds of, this kind of entirely predictable, like these kind of entirely predictable propaganda narratives, always having to do with sex, always having to do with, you know, the destruction of innocent victims. Like, you know, there's like a pattern here, and obviously, like, that inflames the passions of people in a way that, and I see it too. Like, people, I was like, I got like 50 emails or like DMs from people saying, you're a piece of shit. You support rape, you fuck, I'm going to kill you. It's like, what are you talking about? Because it's like, you know, it's like in these people's minds, like they can't, they're not capable of discerning that like things they see on TV or the internet, like aren't reality or like aren't happening to them or like, or that there's, you know, there's facts and a paradigm present that, you know, supersedes like bad guys raping women. Like, you know, it's really kind of fascinating. It's a study in human psychology, albeit it's banal and it's kind of upsetting. But
well, it goes back to what I was saying about it's about, I think, going back to what people wanting somebody to be true. If you can attribute the worst possible crimes to a group of people, then you can do whatever you want to those people and not feel bad about it. Because obviously, well, look, they're mother rapers and murderers and look, and I've always been very neutral on both the Hamas Palestine and Israel in general. I recognize that neither side are my friends. They're not interested in me or in helping me at all. I wish them good luck and God bless and hope they figure these things out. But as you alluded to, the issue, of course, is that it does involve us, because geopolitics, whether you like it or not, is part of your life, and movements in Levant are going to actually start affecting, you know, whether we send people out to the desert to die again, and, you know, just general policies. And if, you know, if we have to print out more money to beef up a war measures in Israel, what does that do to our, you know, to your local economy? Well, we're going to find out, because that seems to be the case. I want to touch on two other things, Thomas, while we have you here. One is that the absolute disappearance of Ukraine from the media narrative, which I thought was a little bit beyond coincidental. Let's put it that way. Especially as we're getting reports that the entire Ukrainian offensive line is now completely crumbling in real time. And then, of course, now everyone's fearing World War III. So maybe you can just comment on the first briefly, but especially with the second, I'll defer to your expertise. What should we be looking for if we are worried about World War III, how would that actually come about from this conflict?
I'll address that question first. World War III, and the way people bandy it, isn't possible at present. People forget, or they don't. The 20th century was totally, 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 totally abnormal. Okay, things like that happen literally once every 1,000 years, if that. You know, this is like, there's really nothing you can like extrapolate from that, like generally about the status quo on at temporal scale as regards power politics, because that basically almost never, ever, ever, ever happens. Okay, it was a uniquely dangerous strategic landscape. Although there was like only a handful of conflict dyads, if they were tripped, they would have almost inevitably led to like general nuclear war. And I never accepted like Carl Sagan's kind of peacenik view that this is the end of life as we know it. No, but if 200 million people dead like worldwide, like that does change life as you know it. Okay, there's no chance of that kind of escalation happening, because there's not the political will, there's not the forces in being, there's not the mobilization, there's not the ongoing mobilization of war readiness, there's not the mindset, there's not the knowledge even to like do that anymore. But also like it wouldn't, like the constellation of alliances would not develop whereby that kind of destruction at scale is possible. What I believe is kind of the main conflict theater in the 21st century is Central Asia. I do agree somewhat with a lot of what Pepe Escobar says. Not entirely, but when he describes Central Asia as like a continent unto itself, and if you looked at it as like a discrete continent, it has like the majority of the world's remaining like coveted natural energy resources, petroleum, natural gas, you know, all these things, you know, a huge percentage of the global population. There's basically like a great game, like war, like low intensity war developed between like the United States, China, Turkey, the Russian Federation, like secondary players are Iran and Kazakhstan, you know, and some of these other countries. And there's potential for that by mid-century, I think, to trip into like a hot general war between like some constellation of those combatants. But I think that that's really kind of the only like burgeoning conflict dyad that has like potential for like general war between like nation states in the way we think of it, like combined arms, possibly even tactical nuclear weapons if things get to that point. But I don't like, I mean, the issue with the Near East is that if America is going to simply say, no matter what, you know, we're gonna fight some like racial holy war, literally for the posterity of the Zionist state as it exists. We will not compromise. We will not give an inch. We will not allow the state to be reconstituted into like this kind of like multi-ethnic, like, you know, like kind of like normal, like managerial regime. You know, there's a potential for like a real bloodbath there, owing to both, you know, an unreasonable kind of spirit of vengeance, as well as a total like lack of conceptual literacy on the reality of these things. At the same time, I believe that it's quite obvious Russia, to a lesser degree China, because their interests are different and there's less of a military aspect to it, but also Iran, Saudi Arabia, Syria, these constellations of lesser like Arab and Islamic states, you know, who are on permanent enemy footing with America, Israel. People just kind of like letting America fail and like not responding to its provocations and just like letting it fail over and over again. And like, and, you know, I think Putin is a poor warlord in a lot of ways. I think Putin tolerates provocations to the degree that now he's fighting NATO literally with the decapitation range of Moscow, and he never should have let things get to that point. But at the same time, there is like an internal logic to that basic strategy. Why confront America directly when it's hurting itself like more than I could? It's an oversimplification, but I think that's part of it. That's my take on that. Why Ukraine has left the news cycle? I don't think Biden's joking. I think Biden really is like a fucking moron. He's like a doddering idiot. He has no idea what the fuck's going on. Even when he was a young man, there's that footage of like him talking to Clarence Thomas saying like, "You and I understand each other." And Thomas is like, "Senator, I literally have no idea what you're talking about." You know, like the guy's like a fucking idiot. So like when Biden comes out and says like we're gonna stand with Ukraine to the end, he has no concept of what that means. Okay, the people who do understand what that means in the Pentagon or do have a clear picture, I've said from inception, it's just about money and clout and hurting Ivan because they've got, you know, these kinds of perverse tribal prejudices owing to their own parentage, or they've taken them on or something. But there's no. There will never be some military path to victory for Ukraine. There's absolutely no chance Ukraine can defeat the armed forces of the Russian Federation, chase the remainder of it into Russia, annihilate it, go to Moscow, occupy it, prevent Russia from ever reconstituting forces, and then declare victory. There's no chance of that happening. None. Like, the odds of that happening are of me like going to like play professional football in the NFL tomorrow. Okay, it's literally a fantasy. It can't happen. So the purpose of this war has always been, you know, basically, you know, I'm not one of these people who claims like, oh, war is all about big business and bankers. But there's an aspect of war profiteering, especially now, because there's like nothing else going on in that regard. these like Zionist types, they don't give a fuck about Ukrainian people. If Ukraine turns into like a wasteland, it turns into like a big cemetery, they don't care. Because their idea is like, well, you know, for a few years we hurt Russia, so fuck it, who cares? And we got rich doing it. I think it's like that simple. But it's like you can't, at the, first of all, like, Zelensky is an incredibly grotesque person. He's literally like this like little rat man. You know, shows up in like dirty clothes, like, we need the more money to fight. I mean, like, after a while, like, that grates on everybody. And it's like, even people who are kind of, you know, just to be charitable, not really sophisticated on political affairs, you can't just declare for like years on end, like, oh, this the Ukrainian offensive is going to turn everything around. Like, at some point, like, that loses like its percentage. You know, even when we're dealing with, you know, the kind of like goldfish memory of your average kind of like cable news watcher. So I think that's why. But it's also, I do think that nobody thought Ukraine could somehow win this war militarily, but I think some of these fools actually did think that like Russia was going to like internally fall apart and like Putin was going to be sidelined by some like military junta that was like all fucked up, and like that didn't happen. And like basically like, okay, Russia's like a mess, but Russia's always a fucking mess. You know, and like it's so, I mean, you basically have like nothing to show for this grotesque, you know, kind of endless, you know, like parade of human suffering and destruction. You know, based on asinine rhetoric and kind of hysterically bigoted, you know, kind of declarations that without any substance. I mean, I think that's what it is. I think it's that simple.
Well, I think that pigeonholes that leads us into where we can wrap up here is that it's, I think one of the difficulties is trying to understand wind conditions. You know, a lot of people now openly speculating about why Hamas is doing what they're doing. Obviously, if Hamas isn't going to be able to take over Israel from Gaza by itself, it's the actions seem to be just almost, it fits into an evil narrative if you're just looking at it like Hamas just wants to kill Jews, and that's the only reason they're doing any of this stuff is just to be evil and kill Jews. But if you look at, if you try to, but yet you can't factor that into a coordinated attack. So they spent all this time and effort to be hyper coordinated to get all these missiles to paraglide over positions to strike Israel where they're weakest and complete these military goals, and yet are just crazy evil people. Like that doesn't compute. So, and again, we're into speculation zones, but if we're going to speculate, or if you're going to speculate, I should say, what do you think Hamas's general win conditions here are? And I only really ask this because one of the things that, if I could pull it up here, one of the interesting reports, I think it was out of Reuters, I don't know where it is right now, they talked to one of the leaders over in Gaza, and had asked if he would be open to ceasefire negotiations or any of that kind of thing. Initially, they had said no; they're going to fight to the end here. But he made a statement which I thought was telling, which is saying, "Yeah, we could be open to something like that. We've achieved our I think I forget what word he used, but he's they've achieved their objectives. So that's interesting to me." What are your thoughts on all that, Thomas?
It's a long campaign, okay? I mean, there's more of a conventional arms aspect to it than something like the Provisional IRA's long campaign, or like, or probably maybe a more apropos analogy with the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine General Command. But what I said earlier, I made the point that I'm not resorting to hyperbole when I say that Gaza is literally an iron cage. Gaza is literally under siege. It's under, for all practical purposes, it's under starvation blockade. And it's, these people are boxed in under Israeli arms. Okay. They're quite literally trying to liberate, that space. Okay. They're trying to bring down the prison walls. Okay. Make it clear to Israel when, as we discussed before in live, Israel may in fact be vulnerable as regards like their munitions and their forces in being and munitions and things. This may be an opportune time to strike, or Hamas finally has the discipline and the operational competence, you know, to in fact really hurt Israel in Gaza and beyond, and force them to make concessions of what people might characterize as a human rights nature. I don't like that term, but you know what I mean. You know, to basically afford Gaza like basic access to the freedom of movement, as well as access to the commodities and things that we equate with civilized life in the modern world. Okay. And finally, Hamas is more politically savvy than people give it credit for. In the West and in the Western world, this stuff doesn't resonate, but among Arab people, even those who aren't particularly radical or even particularly religious, it's highly resonant. And they're bringing world attention. Again, I'm not talking about like America and like Western Europe or Japan. I'm talking about like Dar al-Islam and beyond, you know, the 2 billion other people, you know, in the global South or whatever. It's bringing attention to their plight, as it were. Like, whether you or anyone else sympathizes with them, it's not important. And that is huge, especially these days. I mean, it was huge 30, 40 years ago, but especially these days where, like, any kid or any Hamas fighter can, like, pull out, like, his cheapo smartphone and, like, say, this is what's happening here. That's why. And also, you know, Israel, like I said, Israel just got smacked down in Syria. Israel's fighting in Yemen. Israel's fighting in the Levant. Israel's all over Iraq. Israel's arming Ukraine in this kind of like endless campaign against Russia. Like, Israel can't afford to take on like another enemy in like some hot battle theater. It's all of those things. But I'm not at all like a military type, but I think I do know something about power politics, and I think I do know something about the process of political warfare where the rubber meets the road, just, you know, because I do. Okay. But yeah, that's
what do you think of the likelihood of Iran getting dragged in through Lebanon? Because I know my initial thoughts about all this is like, if this spills over to Lebanon, that could pull Iran in because of Hezbollah.
If that was going to happen, it would happen in Syria. And in 2006, that was the last time Israel fought Hezbollah, like in open combat. And Hezbollah performed exceedingly well, okay? They claimed that Al-Quds and, like, Iranian elements were on the ground in Lebanon. I don't doubt that. I mean, I'm sure that's probably true, okay? In Syria, I'm sure that I mean, the reason why Mr. Trump, like, had Soleimani murdered was, I mean, that was the allegation, if I recall correctly. If there was going to be, if Syria had truly fallen to these Takfiri murderers that are supported by, like, you know, these terrorists that American Israel support, and like it was open season on Shia and Alawites and Christians in like the constellation on Assad, basically, I think there would have been direct Iranian intervention. And so we're not going to let like Syria become, we're not going to let America create some green zone in what was Damascus. I think that was very possible. And that's another, thank God, like Russia didn't let that happen. But I don't, Israel, Iran, Syria, the PLO, Hezbollah. I mean, they were fighting a hot war, in the Beirut street, you know, for a decade and a half. And the big fear then was like, oh, Iran's going to escalate. And Iran is more cunning than people think, I think. I don't think they have it in them to be like a great regional power in conventional power political terms. But they're an ancient people. And they're more cunning than people think, man. I mean, so that was Saddam's claim, you know, was when Iraq launched its, you know, crusade against the nascent Islamic Republic, was, oh, these people can't fight, like they're effeminate pacifists, they're a bunch of calligraphers and ayatollahs and Rawafid, you know, whatever. Like but they proved him wrong. I think they're more cunning than that.
All right, let's wrap this up. Thank you, Thomas. I appreciate it. We will be putting this out as soon as we do. I'll let you know.
No, thank you.
Just on a personal note, you know, my co-host Mark is married to an Israeli. I know emotions are. That's not why he's not here today. Yeah, he's not. That's not why he's not here today. He had work and stuff. But I know emotions are incredibly high about these things. I wanted to be clear from this channel's perspective that we're certainly not endorsing either side. It's not a good guy, bad guy situation. You know, we have, of course, detailed our objections to Zionist and Zionist policies and the Jews in general. But that doesn't mean that we wish any kind of harm to happen to anyone on the streets or any specific individuals. And so we send our hearts and prayers out to everyone in that region and hope that we can hope that this doesn't go on for longer than it has to, unfortunately. But Thomas, so I don't want to end on a sober note, but there's no like haha moment I can figure out here for that one. Thomas, let the people know where they can find you, where they can hear you. And again, thank you very much for coming on.
No, you're welcome, man. I thank you. You can find me on my Substack. It's realthomas777.substack.com. That's where the podcast is. That's where we got a chat going, you know, about stuff. And that's where like some of my longer form writing is. Season 2 of the podcast is going to drop like Halloween weekend. And that way, at which point, like you're going to be able to access all of season 1 for 100% free. And now it's literally only $5 a month. That's the lowest I can make it without eating a loss. I'm hoping within 2024 I can make like everything free, but I'm trying to make things like literally like as cheap as possible without, you know, but I'm on Twitter or like X right now. I mean, I never know if I'm going to get like nuked off these social media platforms, but, I'm there at a real capital REAL _ #7 HOMAS777. I got banned from Telegram again for like some reason. I mean, there's people on there like literally like post like snuff porn and like they practically
again
for like saying like mean things about Ukraine or like Israel, or it's insane. Like this happened like 5 times. I do not like Telegram at all. I only was fucking with it because like every time I got nuked, people like begged me to come back because like that's, you know, that's like the platform a lot of people like, but I'm not on there right now. I don't really want to return. And it's just like grimy about it, man. But that's basically, and I'm launching I spent the summer like shooting content for my channel. The channel's Thomas TV on YouTube. It's not populated by stuff yet other than like, you know, some like tests and introductory stuff. But I mean, I'm based in 2024 in season 2 of the pod. I'm sexing it up a lot. And I've been blessed, you know, with a great editor, and cameraman, but also, you know, I want to transition more to like video content. So that's basically like what I'm trying to do. And as a whole lot of people are going to test, I'm always traveling over the place and like meeting people. Like, if you want to meet me, that is like incredibly easy to do. And I'm all about social capital, and all kinds of people can vouch for me, man. So don't hesitate to reach out if like you want to do that too. That's all I got.
Thank you again, Thomas. Thank you again for everyone who's watching, listening. Of course, subscribe and share and like the channel. Send us, we are experiencing unprecedented growth in the last year. So we always like to see that those numbers go up a little bit. Subscribe to our Patreon or Substack. I'll be putting up more and more content there. That'll be exclusive there to give everyone some little treats. And say thank you for giving us your money, because I got bills, man. again, Thomas, always a pleasure, man. Well, thank you so much.
Likewise. Thank you, Jason.